So today we begin a new series of studies, and basically the idea is that as I revise this, I hope to republish the book on the Chinese culture. And please take note that this book was published in 1986, long before the, or many years before the internet came into use widely, and so therefore in those days, putting forward a number of observations and application of scriptures to the situations was quite unique. Hardly anyone had come across any reliable book on this subject. So that was in 86 when it was first published. And of course, the material was gathered and research was done through the difficult method without a good theological library around and without the internet in those days. And so it was a big, big job. So when the book came out, it received quite a good reception among people who found a need in this area. And of course, on hindsight, if we look back, many things could have been done better and also faster with today's facilities, but not in those days. So as we cover old grounds, it is with this reminder in mind that certain things are said or mentioned when in those days you hardly have information on all this. So we come to the introduction to this series of talk on the Chinese in the Christian culture. Now, by way of introduction, we ask the questions, why are we doing the present series of studies? Firstly, so that we may know the Chinese religion better. We will define the Chinese religion as we go along, but many people in those days were not clear, see. So evangelism among the Chinese is often hindered by a lack of understanding of the Chinese mind and the Chinese religion. And from the passage that we have just read, we know that it is not wrong to be, as it were, to acknowledge that it is God who has placed us to be of what ethnic group. It is not for our choosing. Nobody chooses what ethnic group you are born in. So you have to accept with satisfaction, with contentment, the ethnic group you are from. You can't wish that you were born into another ethnic group, or you can't be proud that you are born into a certain ethnic group. As we go along, we want to see that there are many weaknesses in the Chinese culture which we cannot be proud of, and therefore from the start we want to take note that we should begin with what the scripture teaches, and that is the safest guide to us in this issue. So here in Acts chapter 17, we are told in verse 26 onwards, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, we are also his offspring. So many ethnic groups still acknowledge that there is this creator of all the ethnic groups in the world, and we are all descended from one blood. Many have lost sight of that. And as we developed our own respective cultures, we forget that we actually originally have the same root. And because of the differences in the cultures, those who are believers would want to reach out to the ethnic Chinese, and they are mainly found in China, see, the biggest group of nationalities. And by the way, the majority there, 90% are actually Han people, and Han people are not homogeneous. The Hans are of various groups, and also they're quite mixed. And no race in this world is pure. Don't be naive about this matter. See, the Hans are mixed with Mongols, and Mongols are mixed with the Manchus, and the Hans are of different subgroups, and they intermarry. You see, if you trace back a little bit of the history, you discover the Hans are not uniform. So in the time of the Xi Wangti, when he was trying to unite China, see, there were not just three kingdoms, there were many other kingdoms. And towards the south, the southern people, generally they are shorter and their nose are flatter, you know, more snubbed, you know. In the north, the bridge of the nose is sharper and they are taller in build, see. But today, Han Chinese includes the south and the north, all combined together, they are Hans, and then they are 90% of the population. And officially, there are 50, something like 54 ethnic minority groups. But actually, 2 years ago, this man, Paul Hathaway, through his interaction with the minorities in China, he did research, and quite thorough research. He found that there are actually over 500 ethnic groups other than the Hans. They're clear ethnic groups. They're not just sub-groups, you say. It is not like the Han Chinese. You can divide into perhaps the Ye people of the south, you know, the Guangzhou people, the Ye people. Then you have perhaps the northerners right in the north, more closer to the Koreans, you say. The Fujian people, then some of the neighboring countries, the neighboring tribes, so such as the Guizhou people and so on. Then on the island of Hainan, the Hainanese. See, so even the Hans are so diverse, but we are here not talking about dialect groups. We are talking about actual, clearly defined ethnic groups. So there are 10 times more ethnic groups than has been officially publicized by the Chinese government. So this is of interest to Christians because we want to bring the gospel to what we call people groups. We identify people groups and they have to be fairly clearly identified. Of course, the boundary lines between ethnic groups becomes blur as we go lower and lower down the line, and the sub-groups and so on, and sub-groups. Then you see that language and culture begins to merge and the boundary lines become blur. But from the point of anthropology and from the point of gospel work, we want to have more clearly defined ethnic groups so that we do not duplicate the work of translation and reaching out to such people. And for that reason, it is of interest to find that there were actually 500 odd ethnic groups. So it must be due to political reasons that the Chinese government only say there are 54 ethnic groups, when actually there are 500 odd ethnic groups in China. But whatever, whether you are pro or against, the point is that from the Christian point of view, this is of interest because we want to bring the gospel to so-called people groups and translate the Bible to such people groups. See? So all in all, what we are trying to say is that the Chinese people consists of the majority Han and also the 500 odd minority groups in China. Then you must also include the overseas Chinese, the Chinese of the diaspora. They are scattered all over the world and they form significant groups of people. We know only Southeast Asia. We know only the Western countries with their Chinatowns. But remember, everywhere in South America, in places like Venezuela, Brazil, you know, Chile, there are Chinese of quite significant number. And even on the islands, Saipan Island, you know, and places like that, you see, there are Chinese scattered everywhere. They settle down. On the island of Cuba, you know, you should be surprised that there are those descendants of early Chinese. They have been there for centuries, and they might not look quite Chinese today, but they still retain Chinese names and they have Chinese culture. They still perform the Chinese opera. Check that out. See, I believe you can find this in YouTube. It's a Chinese in Cuba, and then find out more, look at their looks. You know, they don't look Chinese, but actually they have Chinese descent. Unusual. Tonight, you know, make a beeline, straight go to the computer, go to YouTube, and Chinese in Cuba, you know. So you'll be amazed to find interesting facts like this. And also in South Africa, we thought African countries, South Africa, there's quite a big Chinese population there, quite significant Chinese population, you see. And they still look Chinese, they dress Chinese, and they still sing Chinese songs. So amazing, yeah. So those whose purpose is especially to bring the gospel to the Chinese, there's so much to be done. There really is so much work to be done. You can't cover all. You have to really specialize and focus on one area. So that's one reason. Then secondly, why we are studying this series of studies is that those of us who are Chinese may know how to live the Christian life at home. Help from Christian quarters concerning this is lacking. And I'm speaking of those days. And up to today, actually, there's still very much, very, very little material on this matter. Yeah? And surprisingly, people from seminaries writing a paper on this, there are two or three occasions they write to me to ask whether there's copies of this book available. And just a month ago, an English church wrote to say they are reaching out to Chinese people. You know, they are at a loss reaching out to them, say, understanding them. Is there this book available? Yeah. So up to now, there's hardly any literature from a Christian perspective on this matter. You see? And often those who give advice on this are Christians who have not experienced first-hand living in a non-Christian Chinese home. Yeah? So you have to be someone who is converted and you are living in a non-Christian Chinese situation to understand the peculiar temptations and peculiar pressures found there. Then thirdly, it is in order that so that those of us who are not Chinese may learn the principles and apply them to their own cultural background. We know that Malaysia is of diverse culture, so I'm not competent to comment on how to live in a Tamil culture, for example, but the principles and the approach by which we determine things in the Chinese culture may be taken and applied in the Tamil culture and other cultures as well. So what you need is to know the approach and to apply biblical truths to your situation. Others who are not in your situation, they wouldn't know the ins and outs and what the significance of the things done. So it is up to you to apply these principles to your situation. Now, as we study about the Chinese religion, what it would entail is firstly an honest attempt to examine the Chinese religion for what it is. Here, pride of nationalistic pride or ethnic cultural pride should not come into the picture. See, some of us, because of political reasons mainly, and also because of our cultural roots, where China was known as Zhongguo, the Central Kingdom, and then all others outside the boundaries of China were barbarians. You see, so we have inherited that cultural background, then coupled with the competition and rubbing shoulders with other ethnic groups in a country where the political situation is less than ideal. It is natural, combining these two factors together, it is natural to find ethnic Chinese too proud of themselves, too proud of their own culture. And you overlook the fact that we have many weaknesses that shouldn't be overlooked from a Christian perspective. So that requires honest examination. And therefore, secondly, we need to make negative statements along the way, not only positive ones. Our basic aim is to help Christians not in a non-Christian Chinese background. But although our aim is positive, along the way we have to make negative statements about our own culture and our own habits and so on. Okay. So we come next to ask the question, what is the Chinese religion? When asked what is his religion, the average Chinese answers that it is Buddhism or Taoism or Confucianism or ancestral worship. Before this book came out, you ask any Chinese Christian, they are at a loss what to say. You know, I'm Buddhist or I'm Taoist. You say, Confucianism. See? So if you go to a place like Indonesia, you speak in Indonesian to the Indonesian Chinese, what is your religion? They either say they are Buddhist or they say they are Confucianist. See? So generally that is the answer. But when you ask them to define what it is, why is it that you are supposed to be Confucianist and yet you worship Buddha, and yeah, Buddhist, you discover it's not just the statue of Buddha, you have the Lohan with all the arms raised and different fierce looks, and then you worship those as well. You worship Kuan Yin and you worship, so who exactly is Kuan Yin? You see, then you worship Lhasa as well, you see, and various other deities. So yeah, at a loss to describe what faith that you belong to. That is why it was a very bold move after exposure, growing up in such a situation and exposure, and then thinking over issues. It was a bold move to say, actually, we have to give a name to it. So what name to give? I just say Chinese religion. Yeah? And it, and so all in all, this is to help us to understand the sort of religious background we are from. Yeah? So ask any typical Chinese, especially the overseas Chinese. See, I say overseas Chinese because overseas Chinese came out from before the time of the 1949 founding of the Communist China. Then on the coastal area in the main cities, communism tried to eradicate all religions. And religions, the folk religions were quietly practiced and secretly only in the rural areas. And now, when there's a loosening of the situation and the communist government itself is acknowledging that there is a spiritual void in them, they are just pursuing materialism. So they are now trying to introduce Confucianism. Then it is then that you discover these folk religions in the rural areas, especially among the ethnic groups, you begin to become more dominant. And the coastal cities, the people whose religion have been wiped away by communism, they are at a loss, the spiritual vacuum. You want them to come back to Buddhism, or what exactly it is, and Confucianism. See? So we talk more, we are saying before the communists took over, the religion of China is a hotspot of many things all mixed together, and they were carried overseas by the overseas Chinese. So how do you then describe that? That is obviously something distinct, it's peculiar to the Chinese, and yet it is such a hotspot, and you don't know how to draw the boundary lines. And this is where it was really a bold move to say, we call it the Chinese religion. And you, as you analyze it, you discover there are three strands of major influences: Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. Confucianism has contributed to the moral, intellectual aspect of the Chinese religion. So moral and intellectual, that means the correct way of behaving. So generally we will say, you know, the third part, how do you behave, how do you carry yourself with regard to your interaction with others and in society. See? So the intellectual aspect, the principles behind it, see? How do you argue out a case for your behavior. See? So these are the Confucianism provides the grounding for the moral intellectual aspect. And what about Taoism? Taoism has given to the Chinese religion its mystical content. There is quite a fair bit of philosophy behind it as well. And generally, it is the yin-yang principle and development from there is attributed to Taoism. But because it's so diverse and it affects every aspect of Chinese life, it is hard to say who originated it. Yeah? But generally the Taoists would, you see, have the, you know, the yin-yang principle, the double fish. You understand what I mean? Black and white. Say, like two fish, one fish crawling one way, the fish there, yin-yang, you see? And that is the the Tai Chi symbol, you see, and from the Chinese philosophy, I think we should devote a study specifically on this. Say the Tai Chi, it begins with Wu Ji, when there's nothing, from nothingness, and then things begin to move, and things begin to take form, and finally become Tai Chi. Tai Chi becomes, gives us the stability, and as you develop Tai Chi further, it becomes the Ba Gua. The Ba Gua becomes more systematized, and you can actually classify environment and the life of people according to the Ba Gua. So we will go into that, God willing, in a future study. But here, what we want to take note of is that Taoism has its philosophical background, and the Taoists are supposed to have developed the Yin Yang principle and applied it in life in many ways. So this, we are not saying therefore that Taoism is devoid of intellectual philosophical content. It has its philosophical content. Okay? But what is of significance is that it contributes to the mysticism of the Chinese religion. And part of it is scientific from empirical observation, part of it is speculation, and with mixed with alchemy. Alchemy is the attempt to delve into a combination of chemistry and superstition. See? So you want to find the elixir of eternal life. See? And then you go and combine mercury with zinc and other things, and then you do experiments on all this, and together with the discovery of gunpowder, you know, and the use of fire, you know, and so on. So Taoism has all the mysticism involved, where magic is performed, and the Taoist monk with all the chanting, and the chanting, you will have to see that there's a psychological element involved as well. See? So in the chant, it affects people in a certain way. See? And they, with the hocus pocus, with the sword crossing here and there, and the burning of the fu, you see, the yellow strip of paper, you know, to drive out devils and evil spirits and things like that. You see? So the idea of evil spirits and good spirits and rituals to achieve certain effect in our life, all this came from Taoism. So that's what we mean by the mystical content. And Buddhism has contributed to the philosophical and metaphysical content of the Chinese religion. So especially what happens after death. So there's the idea of incarnation. Then while living, see, there's the idea of being still, meditation. See, and combined with a little bit of Taoism, you live in tune with the environment. See, and Buddhists will also agree with that idea. See, then exercise, diet, see, all comes in while you are living. See, so don't eat meat. See, and keep your body pure. Don't take life, because animals have life as well. That sort of idea. Keeping to the eightfold middle path, you see, then there will be harmony in this life. See, then after death, see, the reincarnation from one level to another. So it provides a certain intellectual, philosophical idea to the Chinese religion. So there were other folk beliefs and superstition put in, and you mix them together, the rojak, the salad that comes out, that is a Chinese religion. So it depends on what you want to pick on. You want to pick on the apples in a salad, so you find more apples, of course. But you can't run away from the fact that there are other pieces of fruits there as well. Others prefer perhaps the strawberry in the salad. They pick up the strawberry, you see more of the strawberry, but you can't deny that there's apples and other fruits in there as well. See? So depending on your emphasis or what you want to focus upon, but nevertheless, they all belong together in that one big bowl of salad, yeah, all mixed together, the rojak. Yeah. Then the Chinese religion has diffused into nearly all areas of Chinese life. Examples, say, I give you some examples, and I suppose, I believe you will be convinced that the whole of Chinese life is affected. At birth, the year of the animal, out of the 12 zodiac animals, is noted. So are you a pig, or are you a horse, are you a dragon, are you a snake, you see? So from young we learn to recite, I recite in Chinese. So they, in these 12 animals, by asking you what year were you born, or about year of the horse, then year of the horse, but you are older than me by one generation. So straight away, if I know I'm 1954, you see, you're one generation older, I just add minus 12, you see, and I know what year you are born. And when they are constantly calculating like that, they're so quick. The moment you say year of the horse, they say, oh, you must be born in what year? See, year of the dragon, they are, you must be born in what year? And in, without your knowing it, there is a way of memory aid to certain professions. For example, the Chinese apothecary, you know, the Chinese medicine shop. See, if you see a proper Chinese medicine shop, they have a wall full of drawers that look the same, but each drawer contains a certain type of herb. See, how would you remember it? See, so in their mind, they have already label according to the zodiac animals. So the rat, the herbs connected with the rat, I mean, not physically connected with the rat, but in their thinking, is belonging to the category of the rat, you'll be on one side. Belonging to the category of dragon, you'll be another side. Then along the way, from in the younger days, training just out of interest, reading books about improving memory written by others, Westerners and others, you see, hey, there's similar method, memory maps and so on. You try to memorize by linking the items with animal, and would make a story out of the animals, you see. So that way you can memorize. For example, your mother tells you to go to the market to buy, let us say, 10 items, say, 10 eggs, 1 kilo of sugar, and, you know, say, this 1 kilo of potatoes, and so on, 10 items. Wow, you have to jot down and then go there and find. But in those days, okay. And the person is already linking his mind, say, eggs, see. So imagine that the rat comes and bite through the eggs, see. Then sugar, you see, then the egg is splashed together with the sugar and mixed into a cake, you see. And then the next item, potatoes, you see. So they use animals, so they associate and make a story out of the animals, you see. And that way, when you ask the person, he can mention, first is what you have to buy, egg, to sugar, and potatoes, and so on, because he links it with the animals of the zodiac, and the story is created. A simple story is created about the link between them. See, and in that way, they are able to memorize. See, so with a bit of practice, you really can memorize, you know, a list of things. See, you are able to and he's able to tell. So we have practiced that before. We have tried that before, and it really works. See. There was once we were in Ireland, and then with our children, and two of our boys were there. One was there studying, then another was in Sheffield studying. So we went together to Ireland, and then with some of their friends from other countries, sitting down talking, and then this subject came up, you see. So it was, and the time was spent, okay, one of our boys, you see, tried to memorize all these things on the table. So you give him a bit of time, he looked. Okay, so number one, what, number two, what, number three, what, so it all came out. They're all amazed. How do you remember so many things? See, the secret lies there, see? So if you practice that often, it becomes something that's part of you and you can use it much. I haven't been practicing. I know the method, but I haven't been practicing. There's many things occupy the mind, and I believe for me, my priority lies elsewhere. But it's a skill that is worthwhile picking up, that is useful. So here, I'm just in by way of in passing mentioning the it has more use than just determining which year you're born in. And it goes to the extent of predicting what sort of personality you are. Then that goes a little bit away from the Christian perspective. But for the moment, I'm just making the point that the whole of Chinese life is affected by the Chinese religion in some ways. Second example, at a wedding, a couple prays to the family altar. Third example, at a funeral, monks who perform the ceremony. Fourth example, learning the martial arts, kung fu. Chinese gods are prayed to, apart from the founding father. See? Number five, buying a house or siting a grave. The location of feng shui is determined. Six, sending your son or daughter overseas to study. Charms given to you to keep you safe and to avoid calamity. Then buying four-digit lotteries, the family altar is prayed to and mediums are consulted in order to get the number. Say, another example, initiation ceremonies of the secret societies, and all these are new to you if you are in the modern person who never get exposed. You hear only of the mafias in the West, but you don't realize that Chinese secret society is very well organized. See? And they have different gangs. Today we regard them as bad heads, underground people. They are generally looked upon with negative light. But actually it began well, and it wasn't totally underground in the early days, because the Chinese people organized themselves into clans and different societies, and the martial arts people also organized themselves into clans. For example, the Wu Tang people would be Taoist. The Shaolin people would be Buddhist. Say, the Yi Mei people would be another group of people. So on. See, then when the Chinese were trying to overthrow the Manchus, they divided themselves into battalions. But instead of calling themselves battalions, they call it flag. Because in the old days, when you fight the battle, there's a flag bearer. And in, let us say, desert terrain or in open space or in jungles or in the where things are uniform, say in the desert, you see, which direction is north, south, east, west. So you have to have a flag carrier, see? So when the general says retreat, retreat is which direction? There's a flag carrier, retreat, you go behind that flag carrier, or follow him, turn right, they say, which is right, which is left. Then combined with the drums, signals are given, what to do. So while attempting to overthrow the Manchus, the battalions are formed and they're called by different flags and generally by colors. So for example, the red flag, which may be perhaps Fujian province. The yellow flag may be Guangdong province. So the purple flag may be perhaps, the Mongolia, that side, you see. So there are a number of flags, see. So they have to organize themselves. The top leader in Chinese culture, even up to today, is the Lao Da. Who is the Lao Da? Lao Er. I once went to in those days the opposition party. We wanted to visit the leader of the party, because along the way we got to know him. So it's a courtesy visit at that time. So they were a little bit hassled. Who are you? So where are you from? For what purpose? So we have to smilingly say, this is just a social visit. I just mentioned this name. So the word of pass around, say, so-and-so wants to see Lao Da. Say, wow, they refer to him as Lao Da, the big brother. See? And so in the underground as well, it is like that. Now the big brother, the second brother, third brother is organized in such a way. And generally, the big brother is known only to his immediate lieutenants. below them, they don't know who is the big brother. Second brother is known to certain lieutenants. Others don't know who he is. And they're generally very well-dressed people, you see. And in life, they hold a respectable job. They are recognized men in society. You don't know that he's actually the leader of a secret society, see. And this is for self-protection. They have already developed a system, see. Then the, see, in certain meetings, see, certain people quietly take down the minutes and notes, the equivalent of our minutes, and they will write whatever commands or whatever, whatever commands that's meant to be passed down. So that is a secretary. The secretary is known as the white fan. See, in the old days, the Sao Ye, the scholar carries a fan, so the white fan, the fan comes out. Yeah? Then the executioner, see, the one who executes the order. For example, you have to, let us say, burn down that house or kill someone, you see. Then he will be, he will be called something else. The person who pass messages to others, see, he will be called something else, see. So, for example, the messenger, if I remember correctly, is called a Cao Xie, the grass sandal, see. So the person who run, who wears the grass sandals in those days, they are runners, see. He wears sandals to run. So the Cao Xie is a person who pass messages to others, see. So you know these secret societies, when they are formed, they say a flag, a new flag has arisen, has been raised up, yeah. So in those days, when we hear words that a new flag has been raised in that area, we straight away know what that means. That means a new secret society has been started. Say, who is the Lao Ta? Nobody knows. The Lao Er, we heard it is so and so. Oh really? It's him? I can't believe it. See, you never thought that he's really, he's a very respectable man, but you never know he's a the Lao Er of the secret society. See? Then you see, when is the initiation? Where? You see, oh, how do we know? See? But everybody in those days quietly make their way to a jungle clearing somewhere. See? And then there will be altars set up, you see, candles will be, joss sticks will be burning, you know. Then all of them will carry through, you know, their ceremony, you know. Normally that was the bowing to, and then the certain ceremony, you know, they move, they all follow, you see, they, you know, everyone will follow, you see. Then they have to recite, they take a bowl of wine, you know, prick their finger, put a drop of blood in, see, they swear to be blood brothers, see. So all this involved religion, yeah. So perhaps I'm saying too much, huh? People might think, you know, how do you know, see. So, yeah, we sometimes talk as though we know a lot, but actually we know little. We know, we don't, we say too little, people also think that we know a lot. But this is to prove the point that in Chinese society, traditionally, every area of life is affected by religion. And then for ourselves, note that the word culture is all-embracing, while religion is just one aspect of culture. However, there is hardly any area of Chinese culture that is not touched by Chinese religion. Therefore, you can, it's very hard for you to separate culture from religion, but that is what we must do. Otherwise, how are you going to be Chinese, Chinese culture? You say, so your religion is now different. You have to be able to distinguish between them. So that is the key to helping us living in a Chinese culture, to note that culture is all-embracing, including religion. Although religion affects every area of Chinese life, nevertheless, they can still be distinguished. Right. Then we want to talk about the influence of Confucianism, because this is an introductory talk. Therefore, it's a lot has to be said, therefore we concentrate only on Confucianism. We leave Taoism and Buddhism to the next talk. So here we talk about the influence of Confucianism. Ancestral worship is only one aspect of the Chinese religion. it is an act of filial piety taught by Confucius. Actually, there's no mention of God or anything like that. It's more a code of ethics of living in this world so that there's harmony, there's no fighting, there's unity instead. So to honor one's parents means obedience to them when they are living and worshipping them when they are dead. So that's basically the what Confucianism is all about. Of course, you can argue out, did Confucius really tell people to worship the deceased ancestors? So some argue that there wasn't any. It was an extension of his teaching on venerating those who are living. That because it's an extension, it was carried over. Then it developed into what it is today. So some would argue like that. So some will attribute it to some one or two of the Confucius disciples. So a number of his disciples were known to continue his teaching, and some attribute it to them. But whatever it is, for our purpose, we say Confucianism, as we observe it today, would incorporate veneration of the dead, which means worshipping the spirit of the dead. Okay? Confucius was a philosopher, a moral teacher, and a political theorist. He's really a clever man. He lived in the 5th century BC, before the time of Christ. So, the family unit to him is the key to a successful and united nation. Then there are these 5 cardinal virtues of Confucius. What are they? First, to live a principled life. Second, to be faithful to one's friends. Third, to be loyal to the state. Fourth, to be honest in official duties. And fifth, to be courageous in the battlefield. You look at all this, there's nothing wrong. Live a principled life. Of course, the question is, how do you define a principled life? And this is where the different sayings and different values are passed down in a very attractive way. And to be faithful to one's friends, nothing wrong with that. It's good, you see. And that is why some of us unconsciously value this, and it's very hard to find among people of different cultures, you see. So to the Chinese culture, you see people who betray their own people. They are the running dogs. These are really, you know, looked down upon. See? And then to be faithful to our friends, there are different degrees of faithfulness. But when you find a faithful friend, it's so precious, so precious. Eh? And that's why there is such a thing as bonding, as brothers. See, they are prepared to even tie themselves together by a ceremony. And so you are blood brothers. And you treat one another's family very well, see. And of course, things can turn sour, then you later regret that you ever enter into a blood tie with some people. But generally, it flows out of this concept that faithfulness to friends is so very important. Then loyalty to the state is something that is highly looked upon, see. And that's why you have the story of Ye Fei and how the mother or grandmother, you know, tattoo the words at the back of his back, you know, to remind him and all his family, brothers and sisters, the family members, to remind them that they are dedicated to serve their country. They are to be loyal to them. They are, in those days, don't know his fatherland or motherland, but in later days it became known as motherland. But generally, it's Mu Tian. The land is generally regarded as by the feminine. But I believe there was a stage in the early days when it was the masculine. But those concepts come from Confucianism. Then to be honest in official duties, and again, in all cultures, you discover people are dishonest and corruption takes place. And then to be courageous in the battlefield, in those days, literal fighting was needed, and so therefore they have to fight well. And you fail in any of these areas, you either become corrupt as an official, or you betray your friends, or you are a weakling, run away from battle instead of daring to die for the country. See, then you disgrace your parents. Yeah. Now, the ideal of the Chinese parents in those days was to train up their children to be good with the pen and the sword. Yeah? And this this is where the saying "Wen Wu Shuang Qiang" comes up. You see, in the Teochew, is I got it right, but when in recent until recent days, when somebody pointed out in Mandarin, I'm not Mandarin educated, so my Teochew is "Bung Bu Shuang Bung Hun Shuang Qiang." Bung Wen Wen Wu is Wen first, then Wu, not Wu Wen. So I've been saying "Wu Wen Shuang Qiang." Actually, it's "Wen Wu Shuang Qiang." So the scholar and the martial arts, both of which you are strong in, you say. So the put in Western terms, it will be brains and brawn, see. So you don't want to have a beautiful girl, she's only beautiful, but she's also a good scholar and good at, so a person who's good at physical things. For a man, you know, brain and brawn would mean that he's a sportsman, good at sports and not just good at studies. So if you are good at studies, only you are, you know, like an effeminate person, you know, you should be manly, then you should be good at, you know, sports field. See? Somebody who is very good at sports, but he's a no brain, he keeps failing his exams. So to the Chinese, that is not good. You have to be both, see? So be a good scholar and good martial artist. That's how they put it, see? So that is why, if you go to a traditional Chinese home where there's an ancestral altar, apart from the ancestral tablet where the names, the family name is written with a family couplet, you know, written there, where it's worshipped, you see pictures of deities. And if you see the picture of this Guan Yi, also known as Guan Gong, because Chinese revere him, so it's his Gong. Gong is like grandpa, you know, Guan Gong. Yeah? So if you see a picture of Guan Yi, the famous Chinese general, the picture of him will be that he's reading a book, you know, with his beard there, you know, seated there reading the book with his two companions, each carrying their own weapons, you see. So he's a general, a famous general, good at martial arts, but he's also shown to be a man who is scholarly, he reads a book. Confucius is more known, Kongzi, by the way, wrong spelling, it's K-O-N-G, Kongzi. So Kongzi is a scholar, but you see he wears a sword by his waist, see, you know, the double-edged sword. Scholars generally wear that type of sword. Soldiers generally use the broadsword, that means the curved sword with one side sharp, but the chen is double-edged, you see. Chen, you would require techniques, you see, you don't use force to fight. Instead, you use to deflect and so on. So the scholars generally wear chin, the double-edged straight sword. Yeah. So Confucius, if you see a picture of Confucius, generally, I'm not saying all the time, generally you see him wearing a sword. This is to show to him us that he is good at both. That's why Confucian scholars, those who attend Confucius school, they don't just study the so-called four classics, you know. They also involve in martial arts, especially in archery. They have to ride horses and then shoot the bow with an arrow with their bow. They have to be accurate. As the horse is running, they shoot targets. See? And then of course they use the sword. They learn shui jiao, the throwing arts, you know, and then they learn kung fu, the fighting arts. You see, it's a thorough education, all rounded. So, but because he's more known as a philosopher, people think that he's only a scholar, but actually he's a martial artist. And Guan Yi, he's more known as a fighter, you see, but you forget that he's also a scholar. That's why pictures depict him reading a book, whereas Confucius is depicted as wearing a sword. Now the exploits of Guan Yi or Guan Gong and his two companions Zhang Fei and Liu Bei are described in a Chinese classic Sun Kuo Yan Yi, or Romance of the Three Kingdoms, written by one Luo Quan Zong sometime between the Yan and the Ming dynasty around about 1368. Various versions have been transmitted down, but there's today a recognized edition of it, you see. The official recognized edition. So it depends on, if you read the translated versions, you might have to determine which they translate from. But today the government of China, after doing research, they come to the conclusion this was the original version minus that, and adding that this is the version. Okay. Now these three persons, these three characters in the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, they have been raised to the position of deities and they are worshipped in many Chinese homes today. That's why you have pictures of them, the three so-called brothers, the blood brothers, worshipped in Chinese home. Recently, or just a few days ago, we went for a drive and passed Ulu Yam, and then we stopped for a while, peer into the house, there's the altar with the traditional characters being worshipped there. I should have pointed that out. So we then many such deities were actually men in the past, and because of the they were highly respected, and because of the influence of the Chinese religion, they are raised to the position of deities and worshipped in many homes. And actually, if you ask Confucius, he might argue that, you know, I'm not asking you to worship them as gods, but to show them reverence only. But to the Chinese mind, because of the mixture of all these influences, you venerate such people, you highly respect such people, but respect becomes worship. And in recent days, you remember in Indonesia, the Indonesian Chinese have suffered many pogroms in the past, you know, since the day of before Soeharto, what is the name? Sukarno. From the days of Sukarno, the Chinese suffered much, you know. Every time they have a problem, they make the Chinese a scapegoat, and the Chinese, many will be slaughtered, killed, see? And of course, Indonesian government will try to tone it down and don't want people to dig up all this past because it's ugly, it's painful, and you see, and it doesn't help the unity of the nation. It's a small percentage of Chinese, but they have more people because they have nearly 10 times more people than Malaysia, you see. So there are something like 250 million there. We have only about 30 million. They have 250 million. So they are 3% is more than the Chinese here, you see. And so the Chinese population is quite big in Indonesia. It's concentrated in different parts. In the days of Sukarno, just like in Malaya, in those days here, there were the communist problems. So the government of those days was trying to eliminate the communists, and they assumed that all Chinese are communists. So similarly in Indonesia, so many suffered. Then Sukarno was replaced by Suharto, and Suharto also, during his time as Prime Minister of Indonesia, there were a number of times when the Chinese were slaughtered. And the most recent was 1998 only. You say, hey, really? Very recently. And in Jakarta, many of the Chinese women were raped and killed, and then their naked bodies were just thrown on the side of the street, all piled up. I actually saw a video of this. I should have bought it at that time, you see. Then these commandos, army commandos, you see, they went into these high-rise buildings and then floor to floor, you know, they couldn't run away. You know, floor to floor, they go and rape these women and kill many people, see. It's a terrible time. And then in Kalimantan, also there was these attacks against the Chinese, see. So as recent as 1998. So what I'm trying to say is that then the so-called reformation take place in their political reformation. Then remember the man, is it Gus Dur, is it? The blind, one-eye Jack? Wahab. Abdul Rahman Wahab, is it? I think his nickname is Gus Dur. See? So what happened is he said, from now on, there shouldn't be any attacks against Chinese. Everyone is part of Indonesia. And the claim is that from then on, there will be peace. And then the Chinese were allowed to begin to study their own language, and they can do the lion dance, see, and celebrate their festivals. Well, at that time, many of the Indonesian Chinese who worship, who is of the Chinese religion, they put this Prime Minister's picture and worship him. Right? They worship him. He becomes a deity to them. And people say, why are you so superstitious? You forget that it's not mere superstition, it's part of their system, veneration of people who have done them such a great favor, and they're so relieved, and they, you know, put a picture of him and began burn joss sticks to him. But sad to say, all these are temporary, and not long after that you discover again there's ethnic tension in that country. But the point of the matter is that this is the background to the Chinese religion. That's how it manifests itself. See? So, God willing, next week we'll consider Buddhism and Taoism, the influence, their contribution to the Chinese religion. So, for the moment, in this study, there are two questions. There are actually a few more, but I just put down two. Question number one, Confucius taught people to honor their parents. How does this teaching compare with and differ from the Bible's teaching? For example, Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, and Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1 to 2. So, honor your parents and so on. And then, question two, what would you say to a couple who desire to train up their children Confucian style so that they are good with a pen and a sword, to be good at studies and in the martial arts? But it's not necessarily literally martial arts, but to be good in our physical side, not just mental side, you see. So to be balanced in your development. So how does this help? Is it biblical? Is it something that is to be encouraged? And by the way, generally, the more of the skills, the respected skills, there are something like five respected skills in the Chinese culture. I don't know whether you come out in one of the studies later. So the more of them you have, the more highly respected you are. So if you are a good scholar, then you are a good martial arts person, a kung fu man, both unarmed and also sword weapons. Then if you are good at calligraphy, Chinese calligraphy, then that's good. Then the poem, Chinese painting, another one, six of them, Wei Qi. You know, the chess in Japan, they call it Go, and black seats versus white seats. It's a battle of strategy where you surround the person and then until he surrenders, you see. So generally, the refined gentleman, the gentleman should be a scholar, a martial artist, and if you can pick up an extra such as Chinese painting, or I believe music is included, one of the musical instruments, either a flute or one of the yangqing or kanqing, whichever, if you are good at music, and then poetry, and then calligraphy. Okay. So you will be regarded very highly, an accomplished gentleman. And similarly, a lady who is in any of these areas, two or more, minimum two, any less than these two, you are not so respected. But if you have these two plus one or two others, you will really be highly respected in Chinese society in those days. Okay, so we stop here, and then we will continue, God willing, next study.